With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Is hair a material?
Are biscuits a material?
Are crystals a material?
Is plastic a material?
Is porridge a material?
Can gases be a material?
Are eggs a material?
Is water a material?
What do you call everything that isn't a material?
Sorry, I didn't mean to laugh at your question.
And yet you continue to do so.
Hello, and welcome back to Handmade, the making podcast with real talk about materials. I'm your host, Anna Pajewski, and this episode I talked to Dr. Michael Rivera about bone. Michael is an anthropologist and archaeologist, and he's also a podcaster himself. He hosts the Arc and Anth podcast, which is about archaeology and anthropology. In his day job, Michael specialises in the study of human bone and human teeth, and how we can use archaeological human skeletons and human remains to understand how people lived in the past. And really interestingly, as you'll hear in this episode, this includes making processes and some of the earliest tools and how ancient civilizations used making practices with bone materials, as we'll discuss in this episode. I was super excited to have Michael on the podcast. I've followed his work in science communication on Twitter for a very long time now. And as luck would have it, we were able to sit down during the European coronavirus lockdown for this chat about bone with the usual video software teething problems.
Am I coming through now?
Aha, yes, you are. It's because I had you down on my Zoom. Apologies.
That's okay.
Professional podcaster here.
Yes. I don't know. Sometimes guests.
We met over the airwaves, myself from London and Michael from the Netherlands. And as you'll hear, there's a small section about halfway through where I switch to a slightly different audio feed for my part of the conversation. So don't be alarmed when that happened. I know that it's in there. I'm sorry. It doesn't last for very long. Anyway, enough about that. I started by asking Michael if there's a difference in materials between bone and teeth.
That's a great question. So no, they have some similarities. They're made up of a lot of the same elements. So we're going to be talking about, you know, how bones and teeth are made up of calcium and phosphorus, but the different ratios between them and what other minerals there are in them will be slightly different. Trying to think of like some very clear differences. So teeth is a lot harder. It is the hardest part of the human body because it is mostly consisting of like this calcified tissue, this really calcium-rich tissue called dentin. And the tooth's dentin tissue is covered in enamel, which is really, really hard. It's that sort of hard layer that you brush every day, hopefully. And in comparison to like your bones, it just is a lot more... it's just a lot more tough and a lot more hard. Bone is a lot softer, which is why in many different societies around the world today and in the past, you know, bone has been malleable enough to actually use to shape and then to make bone tools. But teeth, on the other hand, is different. Another two differences I can think of is that tooth enamel, unfortunately, doesn't really have like the same regenerative powers. So unlike bones, teeth cannot really heal themselves or like grow back together. So once you, you know, chip a tooth, that tooth is broken. And so it's different from a bone because, you know, maybe some of us, when we were younger, when we were kids, we had a bone fracture. What happens is like new bone cells will come in and try and like fill that gap and repair the break. But a cracked tooth doesn't really happen like that. You're going to have to need a root canal or, you know, extraction. And then you're going to have a fake tooth basically put in.
Yes, to the delight of dentists around the world.
Yeah, they make a lot of business doing that. And the third difference I could think of is that bone has bone marrow in it. So bone produces the red and white blood cells that we need in our systems. Teeth do not. So bones really, you know, they're made up of like a very hard layer on the outside. The cortical bone is what we call it. I remember when I was an undergrad feeling very just fascinated by the fact that inside that cortical layer, outside that hard layer inside, there's all this spongy bone. And that can be really important as well for sort of understanding that material and understanding that biology. There's a lot of things that spongy bone inside actually provides to our systems in terms of like the physics of how our body works.
Right. So bone is structural as well as serving biological purposes mm-hmm. in the body.
Yeah.
So what did early humans use bone and teeth for then?
Oh, the uses are so many. Like I don't even know where would be a good place to start. But, you know, bone tool is a very generic term that we use in archaeology to describe almost any tool, any implement that is made up of, you know, animal tissues such as bone, such as tooth. You know, some animals have antlers as well, and some others have ivory. So all of these things we would describe as a bone tool. And the uses have been, you know, a lot. So one great example would be to use bones for getting food from the environment. And some of the earliest cases of these bone tools being made by humans, we actually find like in South Africa. I was really surprised to find this out during one of these lectures that I attended earlier in my studies. But there is a species, one of our human ancestors, called Paranthropus robustus. And we were taught that this is a fossil mainly found in South Africa, and it dates to about, you know, 1.2 to 2 million years old. So a really ancient species that lived a long time before Homo sapiens. And if you look at the skull of a Paranthropus robustus, you wouldn't recognize it as human because it is a creature, a human-like animal that actually has really big teeth, really big cheeks. And it's interesting to wonder, like, what were they using such big jaws and teeth for eating? And alongside some of these fossils, or quite near these fossils, we actually find the examples of something that looks like a bone tool. And we can see them. They're kind of like long tools made of bone. They were probably made by some kind of like antelope bone or some sort of other similar animal. And they would actually use the ends of these bones. So you take one of these long bones and they would actually try and dig into termite mounds in order to get termites to eat, because termites to them are really rich in protein, really nutritious source of food. And through this repeated use of like sticking it into the ground, into the mounds, the sand and the gravel would actually like start to rub up against the ends of these bones and become rounded and become polished. And we can actually study this and under the microscope and actually see the evidence that these ancient hominins were using it to get food. So using bone tools for food is a very, very common use of bone tools, but there are hundreds more as well, but I'll start there.
So you mentioned the food applications of the stone tools. Were there any other applications or sort of cultural uses for the materials?
For sure. Throughout prehistory, in many different parts of the world, we have a lot of like ritual and decorative and cultural and social uses for bone. We actually have evidence of bone flutes from, you know, around 800 or 900 years ago in America. And besides that, we also have examples of a lot of bone carving. We have examples of beads and bobbins and things that they would attach to their clothing. We also have bones being used for things that seem recreational. So we have things like something that looks like poker chips. I don't know if they're playing poker, you know, 5,000 years ago, but something that sort of looks like, you know, gaming money or gaming currency, dice, of course. And two of my favorite things. So another example that I have from ancient China is that there are these things called oracle bones. And the ancient Chinese, particularly like in the Shang dynasty, they would write their questions about the future or about, you know, the kingdom or about their family. And they would write their questions down on an oracle bone. A lot of the time they would use a turtle's shell. Not really like the shell that you can see on the top, but the bottom part, like if you were to flip a turtle over upside down, they would write their question on that bit there. They would burn the bone. And then wherever the bone cracks would be the answer to the question that you asked about the future, these oracle bones. And the second favorite thing that I love talking about culturally is this practice called scrimshaw, which is used by a lot of very northern latitude populations like North Finland, on the sort of northeast coasts of Canada and in Alaska as well. We actually have scrimshaw happening. And scrimshaw is basically engraving and carving that is done on bone or ivory. So a lot of the time, you know, whales and seals, like these would be the animals that, you know, ancient people and even hunter-gatherers living today would eat and rely on. And once they get that bone from the whale or they get those tusks from walruses, they would actually start to put lettering and pictures on the surface of these bones. And if you Google scrimshaw, you'll actually find a lot of examples of this beautiful ivory carving. It's really quite remarkable.
Would that have been an early writing surface? I'm just thinking, because I've done some research on like the history of paper, which, as I'm sure you are aware, came out of China. And then other people like the ancient Egyptians developed papyrus as their writing surface, which was obviously different, and then clay tablets and wax tablets. But I'm wondering if, you know, these early very northern people who wouldn't have had access to, say, the wood for making paper, would animal bone have been an early writing surface for them?
I think so. I think that that's very possible. I think that, you know, almost all groups in the past, it becomes a matter of whether we can find evidence for them, but all groups in the past would have had some way of communicating, and they just so happen to sort of find, you know, they would find use for communicating with each other with symbols and with lettering. I think that, you know, scrimshaw could be a good example of them employing the materials around them that they had in order to form messages or leave behind stories on in the form of bone carving.
So cool. And it's great to hear about so many different sort of local material use in local cultures as well throughout history.
Yeah,
I think I was mistaken before when I said, well, I implied that it was only humans as a species that have used bone tools, because of course that's not true, right? As you've just explained, like an early similar creature to humans used bone tools. But there are other species today that would use a bone tool as well, are there?
I think so. I think that there are examples of chimpanzees in certain parts of Africa, as well as some species of monkey in the Amazon forest in South America, that have been shown to use wooden tools or bone tools in order to sort of, you know, scrape termites from a mound, or to scrape insects out of a tree, all kinds of things.
Yeah, It's fascinating. And so it must be quite a kind of innate instinct, I suppose, to reach for these sort of natural materials to use for our advantage in tools. And you mentioned one making process with the bone, which was to sort of polish it. Mm-hmm. What other making processes do we know about in terms of sculpting or changing bone as a material to make it useful as a tool?
Mm-hmm. So the one I've already spoken about has been used in many different contexts, this sort of method of polishing and sharpening and grinding by sort of rubbing it against some sand or against a rough kind of stone. Another one would be just to break the bone. So if you imagine that you have a cow's leg bone, like maybe their femur or tibia, and you were to just sort of drop this really large hammer stone onto it, what would happen is, first of all, you would get to, as a human being, say you were living 50,000 years ago and you're kind of hungry that day, the first thing that you're going to do is access all that nutritious marrow from the cow's bone cavity, right? You're going to extract all of that marrow and you're going to have a great meal. After lunch, you're going to get on with business and you're going to try and make some tools. And once the long bones of these large animals are cracked open, they actually break up, of course, into a lot of like sharp splinters. And these splinters are what are really appropriate and really suitable for use as sort of like picks or scrapers, so that you can sort of like scrape food perhaps off of the animal even further. So if you imagine that ancient hunter-gatherers or farmers, they used to eat animals, they would also have to they would ideally like to scrape off as much meat and flesh off the animal as possible. So that's what these sharp edges of these splinters are going to be useful for. You can use them to sort of like scrape off everything off of the animal. And then, you can also use stones. You can actually use a stone and try and even modify those sharp edges even further. So sharpen them really, really finely to the point where they are extremely sharp. There are many coastal societies in the past, in fact, that have done this, and they are using these cow bones or deer bones, sharpening them up to almost like a needle, fine, sharpness, and then they can use that for fishing as well. They become hooks, they become harpoons, they become spearheads. And this is something we actually see the world over in coastal societies. On all of like the coastal Mediterranean, a lot of early human groups used to do that in Scandinavia as well, in Southeast Asia, at the tip of South America and Terra del Fuego. Lots of different groups were using these very delicate bone tools.
So when we think of Stone Age humans or Stone Age societies, mm-hmm. It wasn't just stone that they were using. They were using bone as well.
For sure. That's the thing about studying history and archaeology. Like these terms that we use will always sort of be limited in what we call them, because say we really enjoy these bone tools, we're going to name a period after them, we're going to call them the Bone Age. Then of course we'll be ignoring all the stone tools that are used, all the wooden tools, all the other materials.
So as an archaeologist then, mm-hmm. what is the process that you go through? Say you find a bone artifact, what are the things that you look for in it, and what tests can you do on it to glean the information that you want from it?
It's a good question. We would first want to radiocarbon date the material artifact. So we will try and sample it. We will get either a bit of the, it depends on what the material is. It depends on what kind of animal it is. But in most cases, we are able to get a radiocarbon date from the animal bone itself. So we're sort of chip a little bit of the maybe the marrow inside, some of that spongy bone as well that's inside. And then we're going to crush that. We're going to process it a little bit chemically. And then we're going to find out what is the date of the material. That way we can actually say that this this bone tool was belonging to a certain culture or a certain time period. If we're looking specifically for, you know, to sort of prove and find evidence for their use as tools, we might examine them both macroscopically and microscopically. So just by looking at the bone tool, like on the surface, macroscopically, we can actually observe some of these grooving effects, some of these polishing effects and smoothing effects that I've already mentioned before. And then we might also look at it microscopically. And this can be really interesting because by looking at the scratching on these bone tools, we can actually find out a little bit more about how they were made and also what they were being used for, which is quite remarkable. A lot of the time as well, archaeologists will do experiments. So they will actually try and reconstruct those bone tools themselves. So this is literally meaning they will go to a butcher's and they will say, do you have any cow bones, you know, available? Can we just sort of borrow some or can we buy some off of you?
No way.
Yeah, they do that. And then they'll take it back to the university. And in the lab, they will use some stone tools, which they, of course, have also made. And then they will sort of bash the bone and try and make the same shape. And then they will use it on, again, some real animal hide, some real animal meat, and see under the microscope whether the ones that they've experimentally made match the microscopic patterns that we see on archaeological ones.
That's so cool. I love this idea of researchers in their lab coats, in their labs, you know, mm-hmm. recreating these Stone Age processes.
Yeah, with gloves, of course, and safety goggles.
It's such a lovely juxtaposition between like ancient technology and, yeah, like a modern setting. Mm-hmm. I love it.
Yeah.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
So having then recreated the processes and tried to understand how the markings have been created and the making processes, what can we then learn about the people from the past?
So it is really interesting to know how people were using these bone tools and also using these bone tools as opposed to other ones, right? To other materials such as stone or such as wood. Thing to know is that, you know, bone tools actually preserve less likely than stone tools. And so if you in 100 years or 120 years that archaeology has been around as a discipline, we have a heavy, heavy bias in understanding how stones were used in human society. We have a lot of stone artifacts that include tools that were used by modern humans and all of our predecessors. We have very low, we have much lower assemblages of bone and antler tools. So any discovery of bone or antler tools that we can confirm under the microscope is really important for us, because we're then able to discover this side that we might not have even realized was that important. For my own PhD, for example, again, like I'm an osteologist, I study bones. I study bones in humans specifically, but to understand their lifestyle around these skeletons, I also needed to look at the bone and antler tools that were used around them. And it is thanks to all the work of people who were working in the Baltic region where I focused on. All of these archaeologists have been brilliant at identifying all the people that were including things like harpoons, bone chisels and bone blades, bone knives, bone ice picks as well, for sort of like picking picking through the ice and ice fishing in the winter. That was really important. So yeah, there has been a really great bias in sort of understanding how stone tools were made and used, but that's the sort of thing that we are very interested in, is to develop new narratives and to add nuance to these narratives about the past of bone tools.
And why do you think it's important for us to understand these people that have gone before us?
This is a really good question, because every time I go home to Hong Kong and I am sharing what I have learned and what I'm researching with my family, I remember in the early days during my undergraduate degree that there was just very little, understanding, because people haven't really been exposed to the fields of archaeology and anthropology that much. But then there came a point, I think around my master's or the beginning of my PhD, where I started to share a little bit more with my family and my friends back home. And I was telling them about what I study, and then suddenly all of the questions came out. So suddenly they were asking me things like, when was the first time there was a human ever in Hong Kong? Or, why is it that genetically we have black hair? Why is it that we don't have red hair? Or, I've read something in the news about this mummy or about this bog body in Scandinavia. Have I studied that? Like, what do I think about, this history or this archaeology? And I think that is really what makes archaeology that exciting and that interesting, because everybody, while they are working as doctors or engineers or as teachers, they don't have time to consider some of the questions that we do in our field. But everybody is curious about their own heritage and about human history and where did we all come from. So building that picture and being able to reconstruct life in the past and how we've developed and evolved is providing those answers for everybody else. Everybody is very keen to understand their own, their own origins and their own diversity as well in all of our like very diverse societies.
Yeah, for sure. So it's still completely relevant to modern life.
Mm-hmm.
But do your friends and family back home think of you as an archaeologist?
I think that they, when I was a kid, I was very nerdy. I always had like books about, books about the pyramids and books about like human anatomy and space and dinosaurs. And, I think that they always knew anyway that I would probably be ending up doing something like academia or doing something like science. So I don't think it's that surprising to them, but they definitely find it fascinating, and the way that I guess when you're an anthropologist, you kind of have an answer for everything. You've at least considered every aspect of human life that there is at some point in your studies. I think that they find it quite fascinating that they can ask me any question and I probably have something to say.
That's pretty cool.
I think that's pretty funny.
What's been some of your most surprising or favorite or funny questions that you've been asked?
The first thing that I think about is not for my family, but I remember doing a science festival event where I had a a bunch of bones in front of me, and I was trying to tell kids coming into the science festival about life in the past. And I had this artist's recreation of prehistoric Japan that was sort of like painted onto a, like into a framed picture. And I had that on my station. And there was this little Chinese kid with his mom, and I could tell immediately that they spoke Cantonese, and they were probably from Hong Kong and had lived in the UK, you know, only moved to the UK only very recently. And so I did all of my outreach in Cantonese, which was the first time I had ever done that also. So that was pretty cool.
Nice.
And the child, I think that he must have been, you know, maybe 4 to 6 years old, and he just saw the picture. And I was telling him about what Japanese people, you know, 4,000 years ago were eating. They were eating, they were, you know, in the beginnings of processing flour, they were fishing. And the kid asked me, did they also eat noodles in Cantonese? And I was just thinking to myself, oh, wow, I have no idea. it is such a interesting question to consider. And I told him that that is a great question, that if he is interested in being the first one to find out, then he can consider being an archaeologist one day. Maybe one day he will find the evidence for the first noodle making in prehistoric Japan that we are all, you know, desperate to find.
Yeah, what an amazing contribution to science that would be.
Yeah, exactly. And of course, I told him that, you know, when he goes home, he should eat lots of noodles. Of course, it'll make him very strong, very healthy. It'll contribute to like the health of his skeleton. But yeah.
Yes, important research as well.
Yeah.
What was the research topic of your PhD, and have you discovered anything equally as groundbreaking as Japan's first noodle?
When I went to do my PhD in Estonia and Latvia, I was looking at around 160 human skeletons, and I was just really curious to find out from the human bones what happened to them between 10,000 years ago and more recently, like around 2,000 years ago. And over that 8,000 year period, are there interesting things that have been happening to their diet, to the things that they were doing, the ways that they would sort of organize their economic life, and whether there were any changes also in their health levels as a response to maybe climate change. So climate changed quite a lot in that 8,000 years. Whether they were responding to different pressures, like incoming groups into the region from the south and from the west and from the east. The biggest takeaway that I found from studying this group in the Baltics, from the Mesolithic to the Neolithic to the Bronze Age and Iron Age, is that they were very complex in the behaviors that they would engage in. I think oftentimes in archaeology, and if you read, you know, popular archaeology books and books about human development, there is this generalized story that a lot of human groups began hunting and gathering and fishing, relying on wild resources, and then slowly they transition into farming kinds of lifestyles, and they would actually start to develop, you know, bigger communities, and they would start to have like stratification and hierarchy in their societies. And what I found in my population was not the case. It's they actually began having a lot of complexity already right from the moment that they inhabited these areas that were quite lowland and quite close to coasts. So there was evidence of a lot of tool specialization. Like I told you, they would make all kinds of different artifacts out of antlers and bones, like fish hooks and scrapers and knives. When they were deciding how to fish over the year, there was a lot of, we actually have a lot of evidence of them having catchment areas. So they would divide up the seaside into different sections, and they would only fish in certain parts at certain times of the month or certain times of the year, so that they wouldn't overexploit certain areas around them, so that they could control how much the fish were allowed to grow. or not allowed to grow. So there was a sort of like very ecologically sustainable way of fishing. And besides relying on like these aquatic resources, they would also go into the forest. They would have a lot of wild food. They would hunt. And they'd also experiment with farming just a little bit as well. So all these, you know, this great dependence on very diverse food sources. So, you know, the Baltic Mesolithic people and the Neolithic people, they were very, very interesting, and they didn't need to sort of transition into farming, you know, that quickly or that sort of eagerly. Why would they, when they already had like a great system and great resources all around them?
That's amazing that you can find out all of those different things just from the skeletons of the people that lived at that time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think so. It is really a niche skill, but I think it's a really cool skill nonetheless.
For sure.
Like if you had a skeleton in front of me, I would be able to tell you things like roughly at what age they passed away, at you know, whether they were healthy or whether they had some sort of condition or disease. What did they eat? What their occupation was, or something interesting about their cultural life. There is a lot of stuff that we can tell from skeletons.
Very cool superpower. I love it. Yeah. What are the most exciting questions remaining in the field of archaeology with bones?
So what I see, which I think is a product of, you know, a lot of our research circles being a lot more globalized, and we have conversations now with scholars all over the world almost every day because we have conferences that are having, they reach far further nowadays. More people from different countries are meeting together to discuss ideas. We also, of course, have a lot of social media and a lot of different outreach channels where we can actually find each other now. So, you know, every single day now, I seem to be talking to people in different countries. Like I'm able to talk to someone in Mexico and someone like in South Africa, in Peru, in Indonesia, and just ask them like, what's archaeology doing now there? How's it going in the Philippines? Anything exciting happening in South Korea? It's just really fascinating to me that the research has changed that much since I began doing anthropology almost 11 years ago now. And from that, we start to ask questions that are a lot more global. And we start to ask questions about human evolution that sort of concern big scale movements of people in the past and big theoretical concepts about the past. When you asked that question, it made me think about this theoretical line that we actually talk about when it comes to tool use in the past, which is called the Movius line. The Movius line is this line that sort of is on a map developed by this archaeologist called Hallam Movius and in 1948. And what he thought was that there was a distinct difference between the tools and the tool technology that we use in, you know, Africa, Europe, parts of the Middle East, and into India. A distinct difference between them and the tools that we would use in East and Southeast Asia, Australia, and the Pacific. And the reason being that, as I said before, there's a great dearth, a great lack of stone tools that we can find in some parts of the world. And anything east of India is the region that I'm talking about. But we have actually a lot less stone tool evidence east of that line, this Movius line. And I think that where we are going next is actually finding a lot of exceptions to this. So only in recent years, in the last 5 or 10 years, we have, first of all, been able to find a lot of stone tools in parts like China and parts of like South Korea, these hand axes that were made there. And the other thing about it is that, what about all the wooden tools? What about all the bone tools? Just because we can't find them and they preserve less likely than stone tools doesn't mean that we weren't making them in the thousands, you know, that we weren't making them. Maybe we just haven't found them because the environments in the sort of Southeast jungle or in the Chinese deserts, they just don't preserve, you know, non-stone tools that well. So I think that with more archaeological work in the future, we're going to be able to find a lot more exciting things about Paleolithic technology in these parts of the world.
That's fascinating. So there's a lot more work then to be done, it sounds like.
Yeah. And a lot more collaboration as well between, different labs in Asia with, labs in America or Europe or the UK.
So earlier you mentioned public engagement, and I know that you've got your own podcast about archaeology and anthropology. What is that, and where can my listeners check it out?
Yeah, sure. So my podcast is called the Arc and Anth Podcast, which means, the Archaeology and Anthropology Podcast. And we basically just try to provide a lot of content very similar to yours, which is educational, but hopefully entertaining. And I often find like when you do interview style podcasting, I think that people love hearing sort of the science through the like sort of eavesdropping in on a conversation. People can go to archandanth.com. So archandanth.com. And they can find out, all the information about the podcast. Of course, you can find the podcast on all of your normal podcast channels at the Arc and Anth Podcast. So find it on Spotify or Stitcher or SoundCloud, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, everywhere that you can find podcasts, basically.
And if people have enjoyed hearing about you and want to keep up to date with what you're doing in your adventures in archaeology and anthropology, are you online for people to follow as well?
Yes, you can find me on Instagram at Dr. Michael Rivera, and you can find me on Twitter at Rivera Michael. I also have I have an About Me page on the podcast website that people can go check out as well.
Fantastic. Thank you so much for coming on the podcast, Michael. It's been really great to talk to you about the materiality of bones.
Thank you so much, Anna.
So that was the wonderful Dr. Michael Rivera. Thanks so much to him for taking the time to come on the podcast. Follow Michael on Twitter at Rivera Michael, and definitely check out his podcast, The Arc and Anth Pod 2. You might hear a few episodes ago a familiar voice. We did a podcast swap and I went on his podcast to talk about materials and making processes. And just to finish up, I've got a very special announcement, which is that you can now support the podcast financially, if you want to, zero pressure, by giving a one-time donation facilitated by our new podcast host, Acast. If you feel like popping a few pennies into the Handmade podcast coffers to help keep the podcast going and pay for things like hosting on Acast and the editing software that I use, that would be hugely, hugely grateful, and it really will help to keep the podcast going. If you want to do that, then you can head over to supporter.acast.com/handmade, or I'll put the link in the show notes as well. So that's all for this episode. As always, I'd be very grateful if you had the time and inclination to rate and review the podcast. You can always say hi to us online. We're at Real Talk on Twitter. That's R-I-A-L Talk. And we're also, very excitingly, on Instagram. On there, we're at Handmade Pod. As always, I'd like to thank Dave Shepherd for our marvellous cover art and Alex Lathbridge for the music mix. Next time, we'll be joined by scientist and aerial circus performer Dr. Nate Adams, speaking about the materials that he uses in his circus practice, silks. So until then, thanks very much for listening. It's been great to have you here, and I'll see you next time on Handmade.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply.